This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And it is always a treat and a pleasure to welcome my good friend, Gary Phillips. And we're going to be talking about this crazy, wild, wonderful, wonderful collection of short stories. So question for you, is it called The Unvarnished Gary Phillips?
Yeah, apparently it is. I was just happy with the title.
By Gary Phillips.
Right. I was just happy with the title, The Unvarnished, but Peter, the co-publisher there, he said, no, we're gonna put you in the title. All right, okay. That's okay.
Yeah. Got you on the cover of the book too. That's really
exactly cool. Exactly. Being chased by the demon from the demon in the track. So that's all good. It's all lovely.
Now, what a great collection, and it really showcases sort of the breadth of your influences. You know, they're coming from all over the place.
That's true. Yeah.
Can you talk? And then you mentioned that a little bit in the introduction, but can you talk a little bit about some of those different influences?
Well, you know, as I think you and I know, you and I have talked about this a time or two, or it's come up a time or two in our past talks, and. And certainly I've written about it, and it invariably leaks its way into, to other conversations. But essentially, you know, growing up, I was really influenced by those Twilight Zone reruns. I mean, the original Twilight Zone with, you know, Serling as our chain smoking host and narrator and head writer and creator. And so it was those, it was the old Outer Limits episodes, I think, as well. And you know, crazy movies like The Crawling Eye and Frankenstein versus Wolfman. Anyway, and then Marvel Comics, all these comics that I've read and still read and it's just a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, somewhere along the line, I fall more into the mystery crime fiction category, but all this other stuff has always been in my head, and invariably, at least in terms of the short stories, over a period of time, these kinds of stories and sort of pulp and new pulp would find its way in, or there would be some mashup between crime fiction, or like, you know, one of the stories in the book is Comstock's Advantage, and it's about a hitman, but he can astral project, and so these things would invariably sort of find their way into me having some fun in the shorts, at least in the short story category. And so then eventually talking with, like I said, talking with Peter at Three Rooms Press, then he took a gamble to collect them together. But I've also, I guess it's fair to mention, I've also then, you know, done some longer form, you know, Matthew Henson and the Ice Temple of Harlem I did a couple of years ago. And you know, that was certainly taking a real person and reinventing them in the pulp way. And so, yeah, so I just, you know, as you get older, I think you kind of want to loosen up and fool around a little bit more with the form. Now, the question I suppose would be, will this stuff start to filter more into like the long form crime fiction? And I guess it's always been there a little bit at the edges, but I have in mind, I think, a kind of story somewhere a little ways down the line where it'll be much more present.
What's interesting is the kind of intersection of, you know, these sort of kind of pulp stories and you know, social history and, you know, very serious issues that are, you know, this mashup of the two things. I think it's very unique.
Well, thank you. I'm compelled because of, you know, just the nature of what I write, that also invariably there's going to be a bit of that woven in. But again, you know, these are hopefully stories that people will find very entertaining.
Yeah.
But you know, as you mentioned, like in Demon of the Track, the guy who's the kind of the hot rodder, we first meet him, you know, doing a race in what was then the 10 freeway was 10 interstate freeway was working its way west here in LA, right? Because it was the end of this Route 66. But in the late 50s, it wasn't finished yet, right? In fact, there's these great old pictures of these, you know, huge, you know, kind of leveled off, you know, mounds of dirt, but that would you know, serve as a kind of template for how the freeway was going to come, and the shapes and the twists and turns and what have you. And I thought, oh man, that's just, you can't beat that for, you know, setting a story there, or setting, or at least the beginning of a story there. And but the character who's the driver is also loosely inspired, I guess that's even a better word, by an actual guy who had been one of the black fighter pilots in Korea. And this guy had been actually really promoted and pushed by John F. Kennedy to be in the space program, because Kennedy really wanted to integrate the space program, and for a lot of different reasons, including just backlash from whites in the program, he was pushed out. And eventually he actually, oddly enough, he became a sculptor, a very fine sculptor, but he shows up actually in this great documentary about sort of early black aviators. Anyway, but I thought, well, what if this guy didn't become a sculptor? What if he still took his, you know, his love of speed and transferred it to cars? What would he be doing? And wouldn't he be in the beatnik scene in late 50s Venice, California?
He served his country in Korea, but he still can't, you know, the tracks are very
segregated. That's right. Yeah. So there's a kind of subplot about how he's trying to break into that part of it. And actually, that's funny. That actually came from my dad. When my dad, came back out here from the war, he had a real interest in, you know, my dad was a mechanic, but he had a real interest in trying to do some midget racing. But, you know, again, they weren't going to let any black drivers, you know, onto the track. So, I mean, he could have worked the pit, but he wanted to be behind the wheel. And I think, and I remember hearing a couple of little stories from my pops coming up at the Gilmore track and stuff like this. And so, again, I think, you know, taking some of that and putting that, some of that DNA, you know, in the body of this character in Demon in the Track.
And enter this very strange Aztec kind of Lamia temptress. that's the wonderful kind of juxtaposition of what would seem like a very straight story.
Yes.
And enter the weird, takes off. Was that something that Serling kind of opened your eyes to, of what you could, what it was possible with a story?
Yeah, you know, I think it was that, Patrick, and I think, you know, along the way, then other stories or other kinds of, you know, Frederick Brown, I was a big fan, I still am a big fan of Frederick Brown stuff.
Yeah.
And the idea that you could have this kind of, you know, bucolic setting. And like you said, it's kind of, you're thinking it's kind of one story, but then there's this other element that kind of leaks its way in and then becomes more prominent. And the idea that you can, again, take these various kinds of, almost taking various kinds of genres, right? The hot rod genre and the monster genre. And frankly, then also having, you know, Roger Corman on my mind too, and those kind of great B flicks that he's done. And so it couldn't help but then, you know, kind of go through the blender and then kind of come out as this kind of story that, yes, that involves both hopefully a little bit of characterization of what Adam wants, what the character wants, but then of course also what the other character, which the sort of our antagonist, what she wants, and how those come together, how they clash.
Now, was that kind of backstory, the Aztec backstory, something that you just came up with, or was that based on a real thing?
No, you know, again, it was, I had fooled around over a number of years with, sometimes it was it was going to be a comic book story, and sometimes it was going to be something else. But the idea, not this particular story per se, but the idea that Aztec vampires would show up, I just thought that was kind of an interesting, you know, take on that. And I probably get that from one of those El Santo, you know, movies from the 60s, you know, who was the mass wrestler, but he also then starred in a series of these crazy movies. I think he fought zombies and I think he might have fought Aztec vampires or something like that. But just the idea that, you know, you could take these, again, these kind of weird trailings, you know, in these various subcultures or subgenres, and then kind of put them in the blender.
Now, you and Joe Lansdale seem like natural, like spiritual brothers in a lot of ways. That would be so fun if you guys ever collaborated on
something. That would be. Well, it's funny that you should say that. In a weird way, we did, although it has never seen the light of day, at least it hasn't so far, through a mutual friend of ours, Lee Lankford. Lee had pulled together, he was doing a bunch of Joe's stories, but doing them in comic book form. So he hired a few of us to take some of Joe's stories and put them, you know, and write them, redo them as in comic book script form for the artist to do. And so I got to do one of Joe's stories called Chompers. and I had a great fun with it. And really the artwork, and I'm blanking on the artist's name right now, but I have the proof somewhere in my computer. And the artwork really just came out just wonderful. It's just tremendous. And so it was a kind of, you know, backward way we kind of collaborated. but anyway, but hopefully one day, and he's, you know, he amassed quite a few of these to do that as a kind of a graphic novel of Joe's stuff. So maybe hopefully one day it'll see the light of day.
Right. Now, just a question about short stories in general. You know, you've always been a very prolific short story writer, and a lot of novelists aren't, you know, but you work in both, you know, both forms. What attracts you to the short story?
Well, of course, you know, the great benefit is you can explore an idea in a fairly truncated way. You can't worry about subplots because you don't have no time for subplots. But hopefully even then you still put a few twists and turns in the story, you know, along the way. And I think maybe because, what is it? You know, so I guess it's kind of the difference between, you know, the marathon runner and the sprinter, but the idea being that you can tell this story, you can beginning, middle, and end, and sort of get in and get out. And then maybe have some fun along the way, and again be able to kind of fool around with some of the tropes and mix and match the stuff you want to put on paper. And I guess in a certain way, I know this to be true. Funny enough, even though the novel, you know, you have all the real estate in the world to tell your story, in a certain way, it's a bit confining, only because obviously you have to follow certain threads. And if you want to create these subplots, you have these characters, you got to have characters pay off. Whereas in a short story, listen, we only have time for, you know, maybe three or four characters at the most. And they all got to kind of come to a conclusion. They all have to kind of pay off one to the other. And I think because you're kind of forced by the requirements of sometimes it's even just literally, you know, a word, you're given a word count and you're not to exceed or not, shouldn't go too far over that word count. The idea that then, can you deliver that story with this essentially more restrictions imposed on you? But I think it forces you then obviously to think more about those gems that reveal character, those gems that you can use with the dialogue. And still tell the story, hopefully in an effective way.
Right. Now, you know, what constitutes pulp and all these things? I mean, people have talked about that forever, but it seems to me that with this sort of fantastical strain, if you will, mm-hmm. the pulps, wasn't there like a time in the 30s, 20s and 30s, there was that whole kind of weird tales, you know, sort of, you know, I think of Hugh B. Cave.
Yes.
And then a little bit earlier, you know, Lovecraft and all that kind of stuff. But this interest in the fascination with the occult.
Yeah.
You know, ancient societies, and you play a lot with that in some of these stories.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think, you know, on one hand, I think I don't believe in this stuff. But like you said, I always seem to be revisiting it. So maybe somewhere deep inside, I keep thinking, well, you know, one of these days I'll write that story that'll be the key that opens the door to the nether world.
The vault of heaven.
The Vault of Heaven, exactly. The Vault of Heaven, precisely. That's right. That's right. The Phantasma will lead the way, and it will be revealed to me. But it's funny, right? Because as we know, a lot of these kinds of characters often have found their way into quote unquote mainstream crime fiction as well. So. That's always kind of lurked at the edges as well. I mean, I was thinking of the Dane Curse and the ops buddy and this and that, and him, putting on the show and the charlatan and this and that. So the con, at least in terms of the con version of that, right. That's always been present. I mean, my God, that wonderful, remake recently of
Conjure Man.
I was thinking of, Alley, I'm blanking on the, oh my gosh, it's terrible. Nightmare Alley, that wonderful remake of Nightmare Alley, where you get into that, but then, there's the reveal, of course. So I think these things, and we've seen this in various kinds of crime fiction stories, these things have always been there. And they've always sometimes been the plot or part of the plot. But it is clear that the occult or the hokum of the occult has always kind of run side by side with certain crime fiction stories.
And of course, LA has always had a sort of this occult, I mean, to this day, this sort of occult underbelly, or at least
No, absolutely, man. I think somebody's going to write it. It won't be me because I'm just drifting away on other stuff, but I was not too long ago. I was at some little dinner party, and one of the people there, and she and I were talking, and she had mentioned that naturally, of course, in Silicon Valley, there is a couple of these what do you call them, life coaches, but people now who are more than just life coaches, they're kind of like these spiritual gurus that some of the 1%ers call on. I'm being somewhat facetious, but listen, they're under a lot of pressure. I get it. You gotta satisfy your shareholders and all this and what have you. And so naturally it seems like a natural turn, right? You're mired in technology, for the most of the day. So of course, where would you look to find a way to relax, or where would you look to find a way to, notch that down and be able to step back for a second? So naturally, of course, then into that void, then comes these kinds of lifestyle folks and gurus and what have you. And listen, for all I know, they're worth their weight in gold, but it certainly seems like that seems rife for, at least rife for the fictional plucking.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the Scientologists of the world, and
yes, well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right. Well, let's talk a little bit about Phantasmo, about the history of the character, and also I was really interested, in the story. He's affiliated, or maybe it's with this group, organization called the Reconstructionists.
Yes.
When I've been to DC, I have seen some of those symbols of which you speak on some of the buildings.
That's right. Well, that's exactly, there is a whole other strain that talks about exactly these Masonic symbols and these other things that were placed, within, the cornerstones of certain buildings. And if you could possibly align them all, that this would happen and that would happen. Of course, that's part of the plot of the Vault of Phantasma, the Vault of Heaven. So, I play with some of that. Maybe part of me believes it, and maybe part of me, doesn't believe it. Or the writer in me says, no, this is just good fodder, yeah, for the mill. But reel backwards for a second. So Phantasmo was created, at least by several different accounts. So I say that in the introduction to the story. As far as can be determined, Phantasmo was created by this black comics artist named E.C. Stoner, Emil Cecil Stoner. And this is in 1940. And Stoner drew various comic books in those days. He worked on the Blue Beetle for a while. And he did some stuff at DC Comics and what have you. And Phantasmo was in the vein of kind of like the Spectre and some of those kind of sort of more ghostly kinds of superheroes. The Spectre being created at DC Comics. And but again, he was like one of those guys who had, you know, gone to the mysterious Orient and had studied all these years in Tibet, and he comes back and he's the, you know, the rich playboy, and he lives in this hotel, the swank hotel, and he doesn't seem to have any means of support, though, by the way, I hasten to add. But nonetheless, then he's able to astral project, leave his body. So his body becomes inert, but his astral form then takes on a solid mass. And so as Phantasmo, he can grow to huge size, and he can lift railroad trains, and he can do all these kinds of things. And it's almost, I think he's called Phantasmo Master of the World. And anyway, but it was like almost too fantastic, right? So I knew that the character, after a little research, had fallen into public domain. And again, of course, I give credit to Stoner as the creator of this. And Stoner, I might add, goes on to become a fine artist. He's in comics for quite some time, and then eventually, I think I mentioned this in the preface. I first encounter him, I think, long ago in the pages of Ebony magazine. He was in an ad for Gordon's Gin. But at that point, I knew nothing of his comics background. But slowly but surely, that was revealed to me over a period of time. Anyway, so the idea was I had great fascination with taking his character and obviously giving him due credit, but then sort of re-envisioning the character, retconning the character for modern day, or at least to say, if he was around then, how is he around now? And if he was presented himself as a white guy then, how is he black now? And can he shapeshift and do these other things? And so some of that is sort of revealed in the story, but I had a great deal of fun with it. And I'm going to do some further stuff with the character.
Any comic books?
Well, you know, if the opportunity presents itself, Patrick, yeah, for sure. I would love to do a Phantasmo graphic novel. Should the opportunity arise. But right now I think there's going to be a couple more prose outings, and then we'll see what happens from those.
Okay, we're not going to have time to talk about all the stories, but I just wanted to bring up some of them that I'd love to get into.
Sure.
Shade Rock, the Soul Shaker. Oh my God, I love that story.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, the character was, again, inspired a bit loosely by the late, great Rick James.
Oh, mm-hmm. I was thinking Eddie Hazel.
Oh, Eddie Hazel. Well, yeah, yes. No, you're right. That's true. That is true. Eddie Hazel is also an influence. Eddie Hazel, as we know, was the great guitarist for Funkadelic. Passes away fairly young in life, but he is that. He does that.
Underappreciated.
Exactly. Very underappreciated. Does that great, great instrumental on Maggot Brain. Just tremendous. So you're right. Eddie Hazel is definitely one of the influences of that character in Shade Rock, as well as Rick James. Actually, Rick James, of course, once he's had the stroke, in fact. And so then again, but again, the mystical part that comes in terms of, you know, looking for the sound and trying to get to the cosmic slop. So again, you know, these the weird, well, of course, and then we could trace that, right? Because, you know, from like Sun Rock to George Clinton, the Funkadelic, and to Shade Rock, or, you know, along the way, Hendrix and certainly Sly and the Family Stone. So again, these kinds of takes on our existence, or the existence within the existence, have been there. And again, I think Shade Rock pulls from some of that to create that story.
So just briefly, can you give, because it's such a great, I mean, you're right, there is sort of a classic Faustian bargain kind of setup, but can you tell the people watching basically what the story is about?
Well,
if you can remember.
If I can remember, you know, and I did that story for Jim Fusilli, yep. edited an anthology called Crime Plus Music for Three Rooms Press.
Great collection.
Yeah, great collection. And the thing was about him looking, well, like a lot of characters, it's looking for the thing that you lost, right? Yeah. It's looking for the thing that you fittered away, whether it was drugs or women or combinations thereof, or chasing this or chasing that. And in this case, because I am taking a page from the late Mr. James's life, the toll has already been visited upon him, or at least part of that toll he's already paying as we come into the story. Right. But he is. And so he's, you know, mixing this new album, but, you know, the sound isn't there. And it is about, you know, you as the, I think being a musician, well, I think all of this is tough, but I think being a musician really must be really hard, only because, first of all, I'm not musical, but the idea that you don't want to repeat yourself and you can just fall into an easy groove and, you know, you can only repeat that, you can only do that so many times, right? Then you got to kind of come up with the next thing. You got to come up with, it's not necessarily the new sound. I mean, you know, Leonard Cohen sounded like Leonard Cohen on all his records, but yet, yeah, you know, his lyrics and the beat and the pace, you know, would pull you in. And so this is what our character is looking for, because he's dissatisfied with the thing that he's supposed to, with this album he's supposed to turn in. And he knows that there's got to be, that it's, you know what I mean? It's like the thing is just there, beyond the horizon. If I can just see it, if I can just figure out how to get there, I can, you know, I can capture it, I can bring it back. And this is, you know, that's what he's longing for, and that's what sets the story in motion.
And the prospect of doing the soundtrack to this new reboot of the Shade Rock character.
A la Dolomite, by the way.
Dolomite, yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Rudy Ray Moore.
Yes, exactly. Well, exactly.
Did you see that? I thought it was actually pretty good.
I thought it was pretty good. Yeah, the Murphy, the Eddie Murphy. Yeah, I thought it was actually. I wasn't half bad at all. Yeah, yeah.
And I was also reminded of. I know we're both big Curtis Mayfield fans.
Yes.
And by the way, I finally picked up a copy of that. I know you got the album of that soundtrack for the film that he did with. Wasn't it Freddie Fender?
Well, Freddie Fender. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Short Eyes.
It's really a great soundtrack. I mean, it's amazing. It so existed below. I mean, I think I must have picked that thing up for 99 cents. I mean, I have it in LP, right? You know what I mean?
Right.
I must have picked it up for 99 cents in some bin one day. And because I had seen the film and I kind of knew that he had done the soundtrack or it was part of the soundtrack. And sure enough, man, it really is a great soundtrack. I mean, I don't think it ever gets airplay these days, but it really is a great soundtrack.
Love it. Okay, let's talk a little bit about another favorite, which is Greg's Last Escape.
Yes.
Greg, what a great character. Who is she?
Who is she? Greg, yeah, it's one of those things that I did that again for, I'd been invited into this anthology, Blood and Gasoline, that Mario Acevedo was the editor of. And you know how it is, man. I just, you know, you just kind of sitting there thinking, well, kind of like my man in Shade Rock. He's like, well, you know, I could do this, but I've done that before, and I've done it before a couple of different times, so I could do a variation on that, but let's do something else, right? And really, I had no particular notion of who she was until I put her in motion. And once that was happening, once I knew I was going to, you know, start with a bang in the first pages of the script, which is to say, or the manuscript, which is to say, she gets found out and is kind of like off to the races, and she's got to, you know, steal this alien tech and bug out. And of course, I was just thinking of, you know, those old episodes of Star Trek. But once that happens, well, then you say, well, you know, what do I do with her? Does she just, you know, bring the tech home? Well, that's kind of boring. That's not, you know, that's not a story. Because that's just, you know, by the numbers. So then you got to put it to yourself and figure out, well, okay, what is going to be different in this story? Or what happens to my character? She's going to get chased. She's not going to make it back to home base. And if she gets diverted to this planet, what happens then on the planet? And so once I kind of thought about that, and once that kind of happened, then it provided then the opportunity to get a little deeper into her psyche and to try to figure out, well, maybe she's always been on mission, and maybe for her, that's not enough now. Maybe that's not fulfilling. And if that's not fulfilling, what could be fulfilling for her? And I don't want to give away that right. ending. I do remember very specifically, but I was very pleased to, bring her to that kind of resolution, which was a little, for me, it was a little bit different. So I quite enjoyed that.
Right. And, there's also Thus Strikes the Black Pimpernel from the Obama Inheritance, which was a great collection you got.
Yeah, and another fine effort from Three Rooms Press, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Now again, that's, now the Black Pimpernel, or that character in there, is very much in the vein of the Pope character, though somewhat, again, reimagined and conceived in a, an authoritarian America. and what would that character look like if that character was in fact an agent of the ex-president of Obama, and what would be that character's goal as part of, kind of a larger strategic move by, shall we say, certain forces opposed to the forces, or at least as conceived in the story, and hopefully it'll just remain conceived in the story, although it came to pass, but it's not, hope it doesn't come to pass again. But what would it look like if the forces of opposition were to have such an agent? And of course, then borrowing certain pulp tropes, a la The Shadow, in the sense of his face is not his face, and he's master of these various disguises. Although being a master of disguise apparently was de rigueur for quite a few pulp characters.
Hmm. Now, I just wanted to ask you about kind of selecting the stories. It's almost akin to, you remember how you'd create an old playlist,
yeah,
on cassettes and stuff. You know, you're creating a journey with the selection of these stories. Were you the one that put them together in this particular order? And
more or less, Peter and I talked about it. One of the stories that I wanted to go in, he never really could dig, and to his credit, he had a few people read it, and I guess because I saw the story one way and they didn't, but that's fine. So we took that out. And but that's okay, because then it made room for the Phantasmo original story. I think we changed the order of a couple of stories, but by and large, I think this is more or less the order that I had thought about them in, or their kind of their relationship one to the other.
Right, and you do have the one that's the virus story. No room, no room.
Yes, yes. Well, that was definitely a riff on the Harry Harrison story, Make Room, Make Room, which became the basis for the infamous Soy and Green as people. And so with that kind of that in mind, but then fooling with it, well, and then, it was written for an anthology around the pandemic. And so, as we know, during the pandemic, the idea was to sort of isolate and keep your distance and what have you. Well, what if there was a virus it was just the opposite. Right? That in fact you had to congregate, that you had to be close to people, that you actually couldn't get privacy, because then there was a danger that you would breed this thing, this virus, and so. But we would get tired of one another. So what if you just desire some peace and quiet for once?
and that was risky.
And that was, yes, exactly. Well, exactly. That's right. Yes.
What was your experience of? I've asked people about this, but It must have been really surreal in Los Angeles during those early days with lockdown and with
you know, it's funny when you think about it, Patrick. And by the way, I say that as somebody who now has had COVID twice. I've had COVID twice. This the only time I've had it, I guess, knock wood, has been this year. And the second time I had it, coming back from BoucherCon.
And everybody got it, right?
Everybody apparently got it. Yeah, well, we're all in the poker game. Everybody in the poker game pretty much got it. But it was, you know, relatively mild, thank God, because, you know, I've been vaccinated. Now I've got the antibody, so I got to wait, I think, 2 or 3 months for them to subside, and then I'll go get my new vax. But you're right. I mean, certainly those initial weeks, right, when we, you know, first you were hearing about this thing in China and the marketplace and what was it, and was it bats, was it this, was it that, and then you know, as it finally sort of took hold, right, and these scary things started happening, people are dying, man, they can't get a breath, or then there was a whole thing about should they be incubated or not, and should you be laying on your back or laying on your stomach, and this and that, and then let alone all the conspiracy jive. But I just remember, and, you know, just, and of course, this is all very recent memory, but I just remember that, you know, you going out with the mask was, of course, just a normal course of the day, right. You know. But then, you know, my grandson, you know, he lives with us, and he was like, oh my God, he's already in third grade now. So he was in kindergarten. He was going for so the preschool, they had the kids, they just put the kids together, right? They just put the kids together. All right. Then he goes to kindergarten, and then he's on Zoom, right? He's in his room on Zoom, and he's doing things and, you know, presumably halfway keeping up and, you know, whatever it is. And of course, kids are bugging out and this and that. And then the following year, he's at in person, but all the kids are wearing masks. And so it's like, so really my experience, so to answer the question, is my experience is less seeing it through adults and more seeing it through him. And so then, because he was like, he had to be tested, all the kids were tested each week, wow. You know, and then he gets it or he tests positive. He has absolutely no symptoms, right? None whatsoever. And then we don't seem to get it because we test it. And that's the other thing, right? That we all started and we still have, right? You know, we all started to gather our, once we got over the panic of not having toilet paper. Right. But then it was, you know, acquiring our tests, right? Warehousing our tests so we could take the test. And, yeah, so it's just, it is, and now of course, as a kind of this other strain has now shown up, it's almost weird that, you know, like when I was just out, you know, went to the store an hour or so ago, and you know, some people have masks, some don't, and so then, but then maybe that's just going to be the normal existence, right? Maybe that is normal now, yeah. Right? That yeah, you know, because even at BoucherCon, there was quite a few people. You know, had on their masks, but you know, you would take them off to be on a panel or whatever, or obviously sure. To eat. And so then it's like, so maybe that's the thing, right? That we, oh, and for a while, of course, then we had a very stylish mask for a while. But the idea that being that, you know, will this become a, what is it called? Not the opposite of the pandemic, but the endemic or whatever it is, where, you know, yeah. It's just like sort of yearly you get your shot because, you know, it's coming back around or it's coming back around as some new strain a la the flu. I don't know. It's kind of interesting. But then you think about, well, my gosh, then you hear about people who are suffering from long-term effects and they think, oh gosh, you know what I mean? It's just, yeah, these very strange forms. And in the end, will this mutate and will this be what wipes us out? You know, I don't know.
Wow. It must have been wild, though, with, you know, L.A. with all the freeways.
Yeah.
Emptying out. Was that?
That was kind of trippy. That was trippy. That was definitely kind of trippy, man, where the whole emphasis was to work from home and this and that. And you're right. So that the rush hour became non-existent for a while. You know, then of course, yeah. It all came back. But you're right. For a while, then you could be out at like five and get, you know, if you had to get across town, it wasn't like you had, because you now, of course, and normally you always have to plot that out because, you know, LA, because, you know, you can't figure out the traffic and, you know, there's going to be some road work and blah, 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 and detour this and whatever. And so, but, you know, but then, yeah, you would just sort of scoot around town. But then you would scoot around town because then, you know, you were either getting your groceries delivered or you have the, you know, the no touch thing became a big deal. And, you know, you phone ahead or text ahead and, you know, get your groceries and they would just leave them and you'd pick them up and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Some of that's still happening, but yeah. Certainly less of it. Yeah.
Well, it developed this whole economy, you know, with like Grubhub and DoorDash.
Right.
And
that's true. You're right.
And what we're doing right now, we wouldn't have done. You know, here on Zoom, I mean.
Yes, that's right. Know. That's right. That's right. And Zoom has become now this kind of regular thing. And it is interesting. And I'm sure from y'all's standpoint, from a bookstore standpoint,
yeah,
you're right. It dawned on me or even halfway in or early on in that, oh, yes, this is how some book talks will be conducted from here on out, because, of course, it makes perfect sense. Absolutely. You know, if the author can't afford or the publisher can't afford to bring the author out, well, this is what you'll do.
Right.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about Harry Ingram. One Shot Harry was wonderful to see it come into print, and it was a big success for you.
It was.
Yeah, which is really great. And also a nod to Soho, who's really, I think, kind of reinvented themselves, you know? And
yes. No, yes, stuff, that's true.
Doing some amazing stuff, you and
Nick. They really are. No, they really, and they've been just wonderful to work with.
Yeah. So I understand the follow-up's coming up next April. What can you tell us about it?
So the follow-up, as some may know, One Shot Harry is set in 63 in L.A., very specific time period, April of 63, when Martin Luther King did in fact come back to LA. This is 4 months before the March on Washington and things occur, but he's doing a big speech here in LA then. So now Ash, Dark as Night, which is the sequel, begins right smack dab in the middle of that hot August, Friday the 13th, in 1965, the Watts Uprising, the Watts Riots, happening in town. And of course, Harry being a crime photographer, a man of action on film, is out and about weaving his way through, the riot scene comes upon something, an incident or soon to be an incident that sets them in motion, the plot. But as usual, Harry's getting roughed up by the cops, but there's also several other things that he sees and witnesses that at the moment don't mean much, but will come to mean something, or come to have significance, the further, Harry is propelled, forward in the book. And in this case, he's not, revenge, or I guess Harry was somewhat motivated by revenge in the first book, but revenge is not on Harry's mind per se in this outing. But he's been hired a la a private eye, or like a private eye, to find somebody who went missing during the riots, and this is fresh off the riots, it's a couple of weeks later. But there's also, as I said, there's an incident, a killing that happens that he witnesses, that he captures on film in the beginning of the book, which is also part of the plot, or the main part of the plot. But then as Harry looks into who the person that is missing and something about their past and the people involved, these kind of things that seem to be these parallel tracks, we start to see them come together. And hopefully there's a kind of organic connective tissue that Harry reveals as he goes into this case.
Have you had fun going back and doing research? I'm sure you've probably had to like look at old newspapers just to see what was going on in those very specific times, or
look at old newspapers. And I've got some great research material, including Set the Night on Fire, Ellie in the 60s by the late Mike Davis and John Wiener. Fire This Time by historian Gerald Horn. Joe Dominic's book, which is a history of the LAPD. And it's a couple other, I have to say, because I acknowledge this book in my acknowledgments in ASH. There's a book a lot of people outside of LA would know about, but it was a book about, it's called The Glass House Tapes. Glass House being the name, the slang for the old Parker Center where the police were headquartered. And it's written or co-written by a man who was a agent provocateur. So, really? Yeah. So the agent provocateurs and the LAPD's intelligence squad play a big role in this book.
Wow. Very cool.
Yeah.
Now, how about researching cameras and all that kind of fun photography?
Yeah. Well, I admit this because I had to correct my own error from the first book, and I knew this, and it's funny. It just one of those things that because I had a certain image in mind or a certain way I wanted to make this happen, I just made it happen. But Harry now has used a couple of different kinds of cameras, but the Speed Graphic camera that he inherited from the correspondent when the correspondent dies he's covering Harry's squad during the war and during the Korean War, and he dies and Harry picks up the first time Harry picks up the camera. The Speed Graphic, it doesn't use a plate, but it uses 5x7 flats that you insert and insert, you know, expose and take out and put, you know, put in the black plastic to preserve them. It doesn't use a film roll. And in the first, I freely admit now my mistake, in the first book, I write it as if it's a film roll when it isn't. So I go right at it in the second book, and I explain how some people think it's a film roll and isn't, but it's, you know, these flats, but the flat, this one particular negative that Harry takes, this one particular picture Harry takes is a crucial element in the story, and in fact, even getting the exposed picture back is a big thing early on in the book. The police don't have it, but they think they have it. But of course, Harry's been clever enough to hide it away. But now getting back into, but then Harry gets the crap beat out of him. He gets sent to the General Hospital. So really, it's his partner in crime and his lady love, Anita Clare, is the one who has to go back into the fresh riot zone. The riots now have stopped, but the National Guard has come in and restored order. But of course, it's an uneasy order, and she has to go back in to retrieve the film flat where Harry is hidden.
Now, do you have memories of that time as a little boy?
Very, but almost. I was just slightly older. My grandson will be 9 in December, so I think maybe I was 10. Yeah, I was 10. So I have certain clear, distinct memories. But where I lived in South Central, we were kind of literally almost at the edge of what we weren't in Watts. But I mean, the riot was more than just Watts. It was quite widespread. So it was just called the Watts riot, but it actually took place in quite a few areas of South Central. So we were kind of right at 59th and Flower, where I lived. We were kind of right at the edge of stuff. So mostly we would just see people walking, going down our street with shopping carts full of stuff, and the National Guard trucks would roll by on Figueroa, but they were usually heading south, further south than where we live. There was a bit of damage where we live. There was some actually burning and looting, but not as intense as in other areas.
Well, it's kind of, we come full circle in this discussion, because we could probably end on 1992.
Yeah.
Violent Spring.
Yes.
Which I was really happy to see that they're bringing out a new edition of that, right?
So am I. I'm happy to see that they're bringing out a new edition, and we're talking about including a few extras in this edition, which will be the, my gosh, the 30th, next year will be the 30th anniversary of the publication of that book. So there you go. Yeah.
So do you have rights? Do you have the rights to all four of them now?
Yes, I do. Oh, yeah. Great. So they're going to bring out, all four. Yeah.
Oh, great. Fantastic.
Yeah. That'll be nice. It'll be great. Yeah.
There's a little bit of cross-pollination with Harry's world too, right?
That's correct. That is very good. The keen observer such as yourself, sir, will pick up on Jed Monk and the Four Aces auto repair facility. And at some point, I mean, all this though leads me to this claim, but I'm going to have to make good on it. There'll be eventually a fifth and final Monk novel, but I think I'll have to set it because, you know, Splane started out writing Mike Hammer or Parker started writing Spencer. And I remember this very specifically. I remember Spencer in that first couple of books, Spencer was a Korean War. These are how old the books were from the 70s, right? Spencer was a Korean War vet. Then at some point, Spencer becomes a Vietnam War vet. Right. And then at some other point, he just becomes a vet. So when I first wrote Monk and I were roughly, you know, the equivalent in age. But, you know, you can't be 60-some-odd years old running around getting your head beat in. So all that to say is that clearly I need to slow Monk's age down. But I think, too, because I want Dexter Grant, his old mentor, the World War II vet, and I want Dexter a bit spry, I'm going to have to set that story in the 90s. But I already have in mind kind of how I, you know, how I bring certain things home in the book. And but yes, it'll definitely be the fifth and final Monk.
Wow. What about Martha Chaney?
Yeah, you know, well, it's funny. I'm actually doing a Martha Chaney comic book now.
Really?
We're finishing it up. It's for Comixology Originals, which Comixology is the you know, they're the ones that turn the comic books into stuff you can read on your iPhone and these things, these computers you kids have. But they also do a set of original stories. And so I had sold them the idea to take Chaney and put her in a modern story. And it's five part. It's wonderfully illustrated by this Brazilian artist, Adriana Mello. She's just one, but the color, everybody is just top notch. And Greg Lockhart is the editor who keeps us all on track and keeps the ship running. And Comixology itself is going through its own things and is sort of imploding, but we're going to get that fifth issue done. And once that's done, it'll run online and then eventually it'll be in print from Dark Horse.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I'm really kind of happy with it. Very happy with it. In fact,
I know that you always have a lot of different things going. Anything else of note that is happening right now?
No, not really, Patrick. Just you know, going to be out on the stump for Unvarnished for a while. I'm working on a novella. I guess I sort of take two steps forward, you know, with my stuff, and then several steps back. And so this novella I'm working on. Speaking of Dolomite, it's very much in the vein of sort of Dolomite and those 70s action films that Fred Williamson and Jim Brown would make, and then it's kind of taking one of those kind of characters, and then he meets a kind of El Santo character, and things are happening. It's called Across 103rd Street, and so it takes place in Watts. But again, there's some kind of occult, some kind of otherworld shenanigans happening, and these all these things come to a head, and then our two main characters have to work together to overcome the bad guy. So I'm having a lot of fun with that, but that'll just be a little novella for a small press here from a couple of guys I know here in LA. But I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Is it fun to go back in time and kind of recreate the slang of that period?
I think so, but you know, I'm kind of cognizant I don't want to overuse it, because then it sort of becomes too much parody. Or when you're watching those old flicks and you see characters talking like that, you think, that's probably overdoing it.
Right.
So you want to use just enough, you know what I mean, to kind of carry the day, but not so much that it just, you know, that every other word is jive turkey.
Right. Now, how about TV stuff? Are you still involved with Snowfall?
Snowfall actually reached its natural end just about a month before the strike. Well, maybe a month and a half before the strike. So I was, it was a lot of other things that we wanted to try to do, but we just never had the real estate to do it. But such is the nature of the beast. So that's ended. And then I've got a couple of projects now that, you know, obviously we're in limbo and on hold the last 5 months, given the strike and us picketing and what have you. But now that we've ratified the agreement, which I think was like 99% of the voting, or 99% of those who voted, which is some more than 8,000 folks, voted yes. So that's been okay. Now, of course, the actors, SAG-AFTRA still hasn't reached their agreement, but they're still in negotiation. But yeah, so there's a couple of projects that were sort of teed up before the strike, and now we're kind of getting back to them. So, you know, we'll kind of see where they're at.
Right. Well, thanks so much, Gary. It's been great talking.
Thank you, man.
As always.
I appreciate it.
Best of luck with the book, and hope to see you out here again in Arizona.
Absolutely. I definitely would like to come out when Ash drops next April.
We'll make it happen, definitely.
Excellent. Excellent.
All right, Gary. You take care.
You too, Patrick.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and we'll talk to you soon.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.